If you enjoy the FitCast and you can help support us going forward, please go to thefitcast.com and click on one of the donation tabs on the website. Via PayPal, you can do a one-time donation or set up a recurring donation to help support the show. The show does take a considerable amount of time to produce, and obviously there's also costs with running the website and getting the episodes to you via iTunes or onto your favorite device for listening to them. If you can, if you're in the position to do so, go to thefitcast.com, click on one of those donation tabs, and please make a donation. Thank you. Welcome back to the FitCast. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and back with me as we lead up to episode 300. I'm very happy to have on the show Eric Cressy. Eric, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. And you know, part of this whole road to 300, I'm using like some ESPN, like CNN kind of slogan thing going here. I'm having a lot of the guests on the show that really I just want to thank, because you're one of the people at the beginning who gave your support to me. I think you were on like episode 7 or something like that, where you got that email from a random kid saying, "Hey, can I interview you for an hour?" And it wasn't only that, but you even let me get in some lifts with you over a summer in between sessions at college and stuff like that. So thank you for all that.
No worries, man. It's awesome what you've done with this. It's hard to believe it's been almost 300 now, huh?
We're getting old. that's what's happening. But let's get right into it, because we have a lot of stuff to talk about and we got some great questions from the audience. And, we're going to be talking about functional stability training for the upper body as well. It's a really cool thing that you and Mike Reinhold have going on. But the first thing I wanted to ask you is, we got this from a couple different people, but I'm going to try to put it into one question. Are there any self-assessments for, the weekend warriors out there that want to just kind of assess their shoulder stability? Or even we got some questions just about like self-assessments for the upper body in general. Is there anything that people can do to kind of see where they're at?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a firm believer that every exercise is an assessment and every assessment is an exercise. So I think sometimes it's about working backwards from what you see on the training floor. If someone, has a cranky biceps tendon when they get in the overhead position, what repositioning strategies can we use to take away, that discomfort, symptoms, whatever it may be. So sometimes it's about seeing what's there and then working backwards from it. I mean, I think when you look at shoulder stability, it's hard to look at it without also considering mobility. They are very interactive at a joint like the shoulder that is really it's built for, probably more mobility than stability. But, I look at kind of outcome measures, things like, can you get overhead, with full shoulder flexion without compensation? Meaning, if you try to take your arms overhead, do you have to go into forward head posture? Do you have to arch your lower back? Do your ribs flare up? Do you hyperextend your knees? Things along those lines. So there are actually a number of different things that we look at, in terms of like scapular control. Can people upwardly rotate to, 55 to 60 degrees? Can they get what we call the inferior media border of their scapula to the kind of their armpit, which is just a fancy way of saying, can their shoulder blades rotate up enough to accommodate overhead activity? But I think really what I find myself assessing more and more is something called relative stiffness. Meaning, do we have too much stiffness in the lats and too little stiffness in our core, which causes us to lead to some compensation patterns where we get into kind of these gross movements. So I think at the end of the day, you're looking at movement as opposed to saying, I'm looking at stability or I'm looking at mobility. Is, I think like Greg Cook and the guys with the functional movement screen have done a good job of outlining that for a long time. Mm-hmm. They've said, let's look at the movement, let's see what's aberrant about it, and then let's peel back the layers on an onion and see what we can do to overhaul it. So I use a lot more movement outcome measures as opposed to just, manual muscle testing or things like that.
Since we're trying to keep this as general as possible, since, we never know who we're talking to on these podcasts and things like that, what are some of the go-to mobility drills or stability drills that you guys like to use in your warm-up to just kind of use that shotgun effect to just try to make sure that you're covering the bases?
Yeah. I think if it really depends. I think something we use with just about everybody, we do positional breathing drills, particularly in our athletes who tend to be stuck in a lot of extension. So I'm a big believer when it comes to going through kind of your shoulder care programs, You always want to work proximal to distal. So you want to work from the inside out. And with that said, you know, we're spending a lot of time on just core and rib positioning first, because if those are out of whack, what you do with the scapula, what you do with the humerus are really, they're less importance. So we'll start with positional breathing drills. You know, we may integrate some of the PRI stuff. We may keep it a little bit more, bilateral in the cases of some of our guys who are what we would call a PEC case. I'd say the next step would be to go and actually look at, you know, are they going to benefit from doing some thoracic mobility stuff? You have people that'll thrive with it. You also meet people who have really flat thoracic spines where you don't want to crank them into a lot of extension. So you have to obviously look at that. And then working, you know, kind of further away from the center, from like a scapular control drill standpoint, we work in a lot of wall slide variations to teach people how to upwardly rotate their shoulder blades well. We may do prone trap raise variations. We may do bear crawls, you know, a lot of different things to, you know, really get serratus anterior, lower trap going, in some cases getting upper trap going in people who are really, really like heavily depressed. And then kind of the last piece of the puzzle is just teaching people how to rotate the ball on the socket without compensation. So you'd be amazed at how many people think they have a lot of external rotation or internal rotation, and in reality, they have kind of a fundamental flaw in their movement patterns where they'll move the shoulder blade on the rib cage instead of moving the arm on the shoulder blade. So we slow people down, work on that. And, you know, it's just one of those things where you gotta find a way to build some length before you build the stability to help hold it in place. Mm-hmm.
Let's hit on the PRI subject, because we had people asking about that, and it's something that has come up on the show before, and I even think that we might have talked about it together on the show, but it's something that's kind of hard to get across to people through just audio without seeing some visual stuff. But
yeah.
How are you guys implementing the things that you've been learning through PRI, and is there any like kind of cues that you can give through audio for people that do want to try some of this stuff out, because it is really some really effective stuff.
Yeah, it's super effective stuff, and it can be overwhelming stuff if you don't have a pretty good anatomical background. But to be honest, that's one of the reasons why it spoke to me so much, is that there is such a heavy foundation in anatomy. You know, they speak very significantly to the context of us having a more prominent right diaphragm, and its ability to leverage off the liver. They talk about how we have a heart on and a vena cava on the left side. We have left and right brains that do different things. So, that's why it really appealed to me, because at my core, I'm an anatomy geek first and foremost. And I think what they made us realize is that asymmetry is normal. We all have it. The question is, do some people have it to an extreme that is a little bit more inappropriate? And beyond just a series of exercises and things like that, what I think it's done for me is it's become a framework through which we can view why certain injuries occur. You know, it shows us why we're more likely to have sports hernias on the right side. Things along those lines that really jump at us. We're more likely to have sacral injections for people who have low back pain on the right side. So that's where I've fundamentally appreciated it. But it's also something that spoke to me because of the baseball population I work with so much, is that, you know, a lot of these guys are, you know, they have their natural asymmetries from their anatomy, and then they, you know, they're right-handed, they live in a right-handed world, and they play a right-handed dominant sport that makes them even more asymmetrical. So that's what we're kind of working with. But, you know, how do we implement it? I think in a general sense, we first assess to get a feel for, how asymmetrical they actually may be. You'll have some that aren't terrible. And you have some people that are very, very extreme. So for the folks who aren't terrible, it may be as simple as, educating them on just correct standing posture, and just working to get them to neutral before their training sessions. For other people, it's a little bit more extreme, and, we need to throw, exercises like left side lying, left knee toward knee, things along those lines, complex exercises to describe and all that, but they're teaching people how to get into better positions. So, with that said, it's usually integrated during our warm-up. I had a good chat with Kevin Neild, and he and I were kind of on the same page in terms of how we integrate it. It's one of those scenarios where I think if you get somebody to neutral early on in the training session, and then you start to load on top of neutral, they generally stay there pretty well. Mm-hmm. So we'll do, anywhere from 1 to 3 exercises, as part of our warm-up. And then we go and we train. So you know, I think it's really important to emphasize to people that, you know, we didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, we didn't overhaul our training approach. You know, this might be 1-2% of our overall approach to training athletes, but it's a significant 1-2% because what it's allowed us to do is do less manual stretching. It's allowed us to not have to, you know, stretch a shoulder necessarily when we can get range of motion by doing some positional breathing and working on, you know, kind of thoracic mobility that way. So it just has made our life easier, probably taken out as how much soft tissue work / manual therapy we need to do with certain athletes. So I think what it speaks to is being proactive with respect to addressing asymmetry, as opposed to just like waiting for it to be in place and then say, hey, we're going to do extra soft tissue work on the right adductors, you know, figure out why that people are getting so gritty there and then train them to not get to that position in the first place.
Are there any good resources that you'd recommend for people listening? I know you and Kevin have had some blog posts about how you've been using PRI and stuff like that. But for people that just want to kind of take a look at it before they, you know, take the plunge and go to one of the certifications or one of the courses, is there anything that you would recommend to check out?
Yeah, I mean, put it this way, I recommend the certifications pretty heavily to people who are in the fitness industry. But absolutely, I think that if you're in the general fitness population, those events are going to be well too much over your head. And frankly, it's going to be an 18-hour weekend where you're probably lost the entire time and you might walk away from it not benefiting from it like you would, you know, if you had just worked with someone who was trained in it. So what's good about PRI is they have a, you know, website where you can locate a Posture Restoration Institute trained clinician. They also have people who are PRTs, so trainers, that have integrated it more on the proactive side. So you can certainly work with somebody like that. You know, what I really tell people is, you know, look at your posture. Are you heavily extended? Do you have a huge anterior tilt and, you know, a raging case of lordosis, so arching at your lower back? You know, do you have limited shoulder flexion or your lats just constantly tight? You know, those are things to look at, you know, in kind of the sagittal plane. But in terms of asymmetry, you know, when you look in the mirror, I mean, is your right shoulder 2 inches below your left? Mm-hmm. You know, if you take your arms overhead, can you see this huge left rib flare from the front? You know, do you just kind of sink and get stuck in your right hip? These are all things to kind of look at. And, you know, also look at your athletic background. Chances are if you are a right-handed baseball player or tennis player or something like that, or a golfer, you're going to be feeding into this dysfunction over and over and over again just in your daily life.
Let's stick on the topic of like mobilities or warmups and stuff like that. And let's talk about cool downs, really opposite end a little bit. But a guy had a question. There's been a lot of focus on what to do prior to a session, like warming up, foam rolling, activation, dynamic mobility, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But what would Eric recommend after sessions to increase recovery and maintain flexibility?
You know, I think the name of the game post exercise is to reestablish like a good tone. Mm-hmm. And I think what we see with certain guys is some people just kind of stay wired after a session. You know, they stay very sympathetic dominant and don't kind of transition back to parasympathetic. So I think it depends on just about everybody, but generally speaking, I think people do well with some foam rolling. I know Kelly Starrett's talked about the value of that and kind of kicking us back over to parasympathetic mode to help with recovery. You know, with a lot of our athletes, we actually use compression more and more. Not aggressive compression, but you see the popularity of some compression technologies, particularly in like team sport athletes who are on their feet a lot throughout the day. But even like a lot of our throwers, we'll use just like kind of arm sleeves after they go out and they make a start. So one of the things I encourage some of our guys to do is if you don't have, you know, the cash flow to go out and buy a dedicated arm sleeve, we'll have them just take like a long tube sock and cut the end off of it and have it run from, you know, their forearm up to just short of their shoulder. And some guys just, for whatever reason, they feel like they bounce back that much quicker. What I would say is we're icing guys less than we ever have before. I was never a huge icing guy, but, you know, I think we're looking closer at the mechanisms now of, you know, why some guys do okay with it and other guys don't, and trying to learn who does thrive with it. And I don't particularly love icing for a lot of people, but there are still players out there who swear by ice blasts after they've gone through a training session or something like that. So I'd say those ones are good. I think post-exercise is also a good time to integrate your stretching. You know, and I think I remember Thomas Myers talking about like the Viking versus the acrobat. Mm-hmm. You know, the acrobats do well with foam rolling. The Vikings seem to do well with static stretching and, you know, at that time of the day. So if you're someone who's very stiff, you know, it's a good opportunity to kind of work on establishing some new range of motion. So I think it's a very individual thing. You have to play around, you experiment with what works, and And obviously in terms of bouncing back between exercise sessions, you know, we got to look at sleep quality, nutritional interventions, things along those lines. But in the short term, I think compression, you know, stretching and, you know, soft tissue work are kind of your three big ones in my eyes.
I wanted to ask you about a post that you had on ericcressy.com on your blog a couple of weeks ago, and I just thought it was a great post for we have tons of fitness professionals that do listen to the show. It was titled Emotional Detachment for Training Success. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the message in that post and kind of the story behind it.
Yeah, you know, I to be honest, thinking back, I can't even remember what led me to write it. But, you know, I think I remember, you know, probably 6 or 7 years ago, Alan Cosgrove said something like, you know, I'm not a kettlebell guy. I'm not an Olympic lifting guy. I'm not a powerlifting guy. I'm a results guy. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't get married to a method. You have to get married to outcomes, you know, people being happier. And I think what sometimes happens for people who plan their own training is sometimes they're not able to take a step back and you know, assume an unbiased perspective to say, hey, this is what I like to do, but honestly, this probably isn't what I need to do. Instead, I need to get out of my comfort zone. So case in point, you know, use joint hypermobility as an example. And that's something we talk about in the functional stability training, the upper body product. But if you go to a typical yoga class, most of the attendees are female, right? You know, why do you see that happening? Well, people like to do what they're good at. And most females have a greater propensity to being hypermobile and doing, you know, being effective in these stretching programs. And what we also know is a lot of those people would probably thrive even more if they spent more time working on stabilization. So going and spending more time in the weight room. At the other spectrum, who do you usually see in the weight room? You see guys who are meatheads, carry a lot of muscle mass, and don't have great joint mobility. They're married to that idea because it's what they like, and they'd probably thrive if they spent more time, you know, incorporating initiatives like yoga. So I think what we have is when we write our own programs, we coach ourselves, we can very quickly get emotionally attached to a training style, when in reality we need to emotionally detach ourselves from that and instead try to go and you know, find something that's actually effective. But I think it's equally important for trainers and strength and conditioning coaches because, you know, you'll see guys, they're HIT guys, and then they're Olympic lifting guys, and then they're track guys, and, you know, all that stuff. And Mike Boyle's done an awesome job of kind of outlining that as, you know, you've got to borrow bits and pieces from a lot of different people. And I think what we have to remember is that, you know, it's not our job to train a client how we want to train them. It's how, you know, we need to train them in a way that is both appealing to them to encourage adherence. So we may have to do a little bit more of what they like and what they're hoping for. But taking it a step further, we have to make sure that we're training people in a way that, you know, is 100% effective and safe, of course. So, you know, as I heard this, I was actually just thinking back to, I gave a seminar this past weekend in Slovenia, and I was just looking through my notes, you know, like between the 2 days of the seminar, and just kind of looking through and seeing the influences. And if you look through my PowerPoint, you'll see Postural Restoration Institute, you'll see DNS, mm-hmm. you'll see Sarman, you'll see some stuff from like the manual therapy literature, you'll see stuff from Scheitel and Delaney. Like just looking through the whole thing, I'm just like, wow, this is influenced by dozens of different, you know, historical perspectives on how to improve movement and make people more athletic. So I think that's what you want. You know, you don't want to come back and just say, I learned everything from this person, because that's just not a good place to be, because you're not able to take a step back and be emotionally detached from what you've learned.
It's always worrisome when you see the young, you know, young professionals go to, whether it's like a Perform Better seminar, or sometimes they might go to a TRX course, where the TRX is a fantastic tool, but they come back and want to do all their lifting on the TRX. It's usually not the best course of action.
Exactly. You know, it's one more tool to add to your toolbox. You know, it's the old saying, you know, if your carpenter only has a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, good point. I mean, we've been dealing with that stuff at MBSC as well. You know, we've had, I mean, you know, Mike Mullen, he's coming a bunch of times to talk about PRI stuff, and we're trying not to get too far to one end of the spectrum. Remember, what got us to this point in terms of like getting good results in general, and not try to just throw all that out and, you know, go with a completely different mindset for everything that we do.
Yeah. And I remember when, the other thing Mike made a great point of in the functional stability training, functional strength coach 5, he talked about there's what you know and what you can implement.
Yeah.
You know, there are two different things, and PRI is something that has to be taught, you know, pretty intensely and individually up front. So, you know, it's something we can do with our group sizes, and we have a little bit more interaction with guys on a one-on-one basis, and, you know, we can integrate it over the course of time. You know, it's another thing altogether to say, I'm going to teach five PRI exercises today. I'm going to make sure everybody knows what a left side lying, left hip adduction internal rotation is. And meanwhile, you got 15-year-old kids, you know, with Rayquaza machine, you know, in the background. And if you give them balloons, they're screwing around with those. Yeah. So it's really one of those things where you have to figure out not just what the actual approach is like and how to integrate it, but you have to understand logistically how it's going to work in the flow of traffic when you're in a facility, and the caliber of athletes and the you know, movement intelligence that you have in front of you.
This is another question that I morphed a couple of questions together into one. You know, for the maximum strength, the high performance handbook crowd out there, again, maybe that weekend warrior kind of stereotype. What are the best exercises for building a strong upper body while maintaining shoulder and elbow health, just to make sure that they're not doing anything that's going to get them hurt?
Yeah, you know, so I'll take a little bit of a different perspective. I think we all know that you need to do, you know, more pulling than you do pushing. You know, we know that, you know, if you just bench and overhead press all the time, you're going to wind up with problems. But I'd actually argue there's better ways to look at it. I think really any exercise is safe for somebody, assuming no, you know, dramatic injuries or anything like that in their history, as long as they're realizing that, you know, it has to be programmed as part of a structurally balanced program. So, you know, I don't just look at front to back shoulder balance. I look at top to bottom shoulder balance. We see a lot of people who are very dominant in their lats. So there has kind of like this gross extension effect on pulling the shoulder blades down and arching the lower back and, you know, pulling the humerus into almost kind of hyperextension. So there are a lot of people who are very lat dominant and need to spend more time getting their arms up overhead. So I'd say, you know, it's not just front to back balance. It's also top to bottom balance. You know, additionally, and you know, we've talked about this for years, is that, you know, even within your pressing exercises, like, you can't just bench all the time. When you bench, your shoulder blades are, you know, pinned down on a stable surface underneath you, and your shoulder blades really need to learn how to move freely. So, you know, I think it's important to integrate things like landmine presses, push-ups, cable press variations, stuff like that to, you know, train that pattern, but do so with the scapula moving freely on the rib cage. Mm-hmm. So I think the name of the game is really, don't get caught up just doing one category of exercises. Make sure that you're integrating a lot of different ones. You know, the biggest issues I see, to be honest, are people who have poor scapular control and have very limited shoulder flexion. So that happens because they do way too many pull-ups and they bench too much. So what do we do instead? We get them doing push-ups. We get them doing more horizontal pulling. We get their arms up overhead during the warm-up. We work on soft tissue quality, the lats and the pec minor, pec major, and, you know, good things tend to happen.
Let's talk about Tommy John stuff, because it's really been scary just over the last couple of years to see the increase in even post-op kids that we're getting at MBSC, and I know you've been dealing with it too at Crescent Performance, but yeah. Nick had a question. With all the Tommy John surgery, UCL reconstruction in the press and the MLB this year, what are the precautionary steps that Eric takes for youth baseball players? Seems like kids are doing more now than ever to make it to that next level, whether it's college or professional, and when they go from there, they're at a higher risk for elbow and shoulder injuries. So what do you guys do to prevent? And just if you want to talk about that in general, because it's a really interesting subject.
Yeah, so I'm a firm believer that the reason we're seeing all these injuries at the highest levels, I don't think this is a Major League Baseball problem. I think it's a developmental problem, meaning that all these kids are damaged goods by the time they become, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old. And what's just happening is, you know, they're getting drafted, they're going to professional baseball or college ball for that matter. You know, the rates are sky high there as well. But they're getting these levels and they're bigger, they're stronger, they're more athletic. And really what's happening is these issues that have been there for a long time are just coming to threshold because, you know, they're throwing in front of 40,000 people and, you know, their velocity is higher than it's ever been before. So to me, the strategy that's most important is to make sure that the wear and tear isn't there early on. Okay. So it's one thing if you're, you know, people don't know Nolan Ryan tore his UCL in his last game ever. He was, you know, obviously in his 40s, he was further along. Jamie Moyer tore his UCL, you know, when he was pitching in his 40s as well. So these are guys that, I mean, there's probably rusted off, you know what I mean? They used it until it went. Meanwhile, we have guys who just have these insane arm speeds and are blowing out at age 19. In fact, they did a little feature on the 2011 draft just the other day. And 2011 was actually called the best draft since 1986. And the three top high school arms in that draft have all blown out now. Wow. All these big time right-handed guys who are, up in the, high 90s and some of them even into 100 since that time. So they've now all gone. But, I think we know the research has demonstrated that Northern players get hurt less than Southern players. Mm-hmm. And part of that is just the fact that they're not able to play year round. So the biggest responsibility that we have is that we have to teach athletes about an ideal, developmental yearly calendar and a long-term development calendar. And that was something Matt Blake, our pitching coordinator, actually wrote a great article on my website just recently about. It's called Long-Term Athletic Development for Baseball, if people want to read it. But, basically what we talk a lot with our athletes about is that we want you involved in multiple sports early on, and we don't even want you to think about, focusing in on baseball until you're, 17 or something like that. Because earlier on, the advantages of playing those other sports isn't just that it keeps you away from baseball. It's also that it develops this rich proprioceptive environment that makes it easier for you to acquire, more difficult skills later on as you get more and more specialized. It also, it creates a scenario where you can't get into that pattern overload nearly as much. So, really what we're doing more than anything from a precautionary step standpoint for keeping guys healthy, we're educating, we're teaching kids and parents and coaches how to be advocates. We're making sure that we, try to funnel kids to programs that, we know don't abuse young arms. The big thing was a kid that threw 194 pitches the other day. It's kind of all over the place. Sports Center talked about it this morning. And that's why these problems are happening. Those are the kids that, might not get hurt doing it, but then 3 years down the road, they might blow out in college. They might blow out in pro ball. And people don't perceive what's happening on a microscopic level. They don't realize that every time you go out and pitch, you're probably doing some low-level damage to your ulnar collateral ligament. Mm-hmm. It's basically preventing your forearm from flying off of your humerus. So what's happening is these kids at a very young age are winding up with calcification on the ligament. And when you see calcification on a ligament, you can pretty much bet on the fact that it's eventually going to go. What's interesting for me is I'm in a fortunate position where, I've seen a lot of, MRIs of draft picks and things like that. And not everybody has calcification on their UCL. You will see guys that absolutely do, but I've also seen a lot of clean elbow MRIs. So one of the things I kind of do, probably more anecdotally and on the down low, is I follow those guys. I want to know how they're doing. By that same token, I have guys that I saw, 4 years ago who were, started up with us when they had calcification on their UCL, and they're still pitching pain-free. And whether that's because we've done a good job training them, they've stayed on top of their tissue quality, or they just haven't reached that threshold yet, it's hard to say. But, I'm certainly not perfect. And really, regardless of what people tell you, nobody's perfect. There are always going to be arm injuries because we don't know what kind of athletes we're acquiring. When someone comes in to start training with you at age 18, 19, 20, you had no control over the volume that they went through, when they were 13, 14, 15. And that's where I think we need to, to really take a really hard look at this as a society and say, what can we do to make sure that these kids are not getting so banged up and destroyed at the young levels? How can we safely develop arm speed while having plenty of breaks in the calendar to make sure that kids aren't getting overused?
Is this something where you're normally addressing the parents first and foremost? Is this something where you can talk to the coaches of the baseball teams as well?
It's a little bit of both. Yeah. I'd say that ultimately, coaches can be definitely tricky because most of them have a semblance of vested financial interest, mm-hmm. Not so much on the high school side of things, but more on like the AAU side.
Exactly,
of things.
Yeah.
At the college level, it's tricky too, because there are people that they need to keep their jobs. Mm-hmm. So, there are a couple of big time names in this year's draft who have been heavily, heavily used, and their coaches have been absolutely ripped apart in the media. But that's unfortunate, and you hope that recruits see that they have a track record of abusing young arms and that they won't wind up there. But
you know, it kind of is what it is. You fall in love with a school and you kind of have to go with the coach that's there. So, you know, I think, you know, if we can educate the kid and we can educate the parent, those are the two most important things. Because really the parent's the one that's going to be the one speaking up probably until age 15, 16. You know, I'd like to have kids be more proactive at a younger age, but it's really not happening until later on. So, you know, I know for us, what's good is we spend a lot of time helping kids who are trying to find the right school for them and all that. And I have no problem sharing with a kid, you know, that particular universities have a track record of abusing arms, mm-hmm. you know, that they're places that have, you know, graduate assistant athletic trainers who have never spent a day working with baseball and they refuse to do manual therapy. So, you know, we're talking about kids' future. I'm not worried about hurting feelings or anything like that. So we certainly have, you know, places where we're, you know, thrilled to send players. We've had outstanding results with places like, you know, Vanderbilt, you know, great program, awesome athletic trainer, big attention to detail. You know, Coastal Carolina, great guys, you know, very forward thinking, trying to do a good job to take care of people. And if you look at the numbers, you can see that it works. You know, the numbers are in terms of injury rates, guys are staying healthy and they're doing well. So, you know, those are just a couple schools that I really have spoken highly about, but there are definitely more out there that are fighting the good fight and doing it the right way. But at the end of the day, you got to prepare the kid, you know, because that kid's going to become an adult and you need him to speak up for himself when the day comes.
I was curious what your position was on just like maintaining athleticism in adults, because obviously as people get older, they tend to slow down. We try to offset some of the stuff with like med ball work and things like that. But do you think it's important for adults to, you know, when they get to their like late 20s, 30s and 40s to try to still hold on to some athleticism by doing some more athletic movements in their workouts? Or is that something that is probably just, you know, not worth the risk?
I think it's definitely important to do, because as we know, like as people get older, you know, really the biggest concern is the age-related loss in power. Mm-hmm. Obviously, people lose strength, but also you lose power. If you don't have power, you're more likely to fall on the ice and, you know, break your hip. You're more likely to you know, get yanked by your dog while you're out for a walk and you know, separate a shoulder or something like that. So certainly I do think it's important. I think what's different about what we do with our younger athletes is we have to find ways to train it in a safer environment. I mean, we can't just ask our 55-year-old clients to be doing like depth jumps and, you know, power skips and stuff like that, or we're going to have Achilles tendons blown out all over the place. You know, I think you can do more stuff, things like kettlebell swings. You know, you could do sled sprints so there's less ground reaction forces. You could work on doing some hill sprints. You can, you know, there's a lot of different ways to attack that, you know, without necessarily, like you mentioned, med ball stuff, without necessarily, you know, putting a ton of stress on people's body. And the other thing too is we need to be cognizant. Let's get people out of that sagittal plane. You know, traditional strength and conditioning has been so sagittal plane dominant that, you know, do some lateral lunges, get going on a slide board, you know, whatever it takes, and even just stand on one leg more often. You know, because if you might be working in the sagittal plane, but you're doing a lot of stabilization work in the frontal and the transverse plane when you're in that position. So I think it's an incredibly important thing. And, you know, the worst thing you can do is get somebody who's lost their athleticism, you know, and they're in their 40s trying to get it back, because they still, in many cases, have that competitive instinct. And that's why so many people, you know, they go and they get hurt sometimes.
We got one more question on conditioning, but before we jump into that, can you talk a little bit about functional stability training for the upper body and the, you know, the program that you put together with Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it was interesting. We filmed Optimal Shoulder Performance together back in 2009. It was our first collaborative project, and really got some great feedback on it. And, you know, it moved on, and we did functional stability training of the core and then of the lower body. And Mike and I kind of reconvened this past year, and we were talking about it, like, wow, people ask about a functional stability training of the upper body all the time. And we both agreed that, you know, a lot of our thought processes had changed since 2009 when we did that shoulder DVD. And to be honest, we wanted to talk a little bit more about the elbow. We wanted to talk about thorax position and scapular control and stuff, things that we didn't get to as much with the OSP DVD. So it's still very applicable. It's just a little bit dated now. So with that said, we wanted to kind of put our minds together and attack this. And, you know, I was really pleased with how it came out. Both of us did a couple of webinars and a couple of hands-on lab segments. So it's a full day-long seminar that we filmed, you know, either, you know, in the webinar's case on our computers. And then with the lab, we did a half-day seminar that was attended by, you know, 20 or so trainers and coaches. So, you know, I think it's very, very specific to the upper extremity, obviously. It's obviously targeted more towards trainers, clinicians, things along those lines. But there are also some things that, you know, just about anybody who's a weekend warrior can benefit from as well.
And, you know, I saw one of the great things is also offering just like a digital version of it. So you don't even need to kind of wait for it. You can just like today, I just want to watch stuff, you know, as soon as I pay for it. So it's a great option on there. And if you guys want to jump into the show notes, I'll have a link for that on there as well to help support the podcast. But before we wrap up, I know we're running out of time, but we had a question coming in again from Guy who wanted to just talk to you about conditioning for a little bit. What are the key elements of high intensity conditioning sessions at CP, whether it is a 10-minute session finisher or the basis of a whole session? Can you give an example of some that he has used at CP?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there are elements of that in the boot camps that we run. You know, Greg Robbins kind of takes the lead on the facility. You know, I think the name of the game, to be honest, it speaks back to some of the stuff we just talked about with building athleticism with folks, is that I think you certainly need to make sure there's plenty of variety within the week. You know, you don't want just people running laps. And that's something you see over and over again. It's basically push-ups and running at just about every boot camp you see in public. You know, we will use a lot of stuff with the sled. We may integrate med ball stuff. You know, I know a lot of people use battling ropes, you know, things along those lines. So I think what you have to figure out, you know, is how prepared your clientele is. You know, is it someone that's very, very new and you didn't make sure that you include a lot of self-limiting exercises? That's what, you know, really those exercises are like. Conversely, if you have someone who's, you know, a little bit more fit and well-trained, you can do stuff like, you know, more swings and things like that. So, I mean, for me, one of my favorite, you know, finishers is a kettlebell swing, goblet squat, ladder. So you just, you know, you do 10 of each, rest 30 seconds, 9 of each, rest 30 seconds, and work your way all the way down to one. That's an example of one that I've liked, and used a lot. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, you need to make sure it's just a scenario where you're making people work hard, but they're working hard within the context of their limitations. I mean, it might be Airdyne, it might be, you know, any of a number of different things.
Mm-hmm. So again, everyone out there, it's functional stability training for the upper body. And also, if you aren't, make sure you're going to ericcressy.com. Always great blog posts on there. And I know we're tight for time. So Eric, I just want to thank you so much for coming back on the show. And we'll definitely have you on again soon.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.